Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. Jacob Birch, Eric Steven. A normal-ish week for the Dodgers in that, you know, nothing groundbreaking news-wise, but a weird week.
Yeah, and in spirit with that, we're going to actually record two podcasts today. We already did our double podcast in March when the like a couple times when the Dodgers made big news, and then then we did two different.
Do you think they scheduled this to honor us?
We had our split doubleheader podcast already, so like the Dodgers just said, you know what, we're gonna make it weird and give us four baseball games in 45 hours. So.
So there is a losing streak. There is a winning streak. We're going to catch you all up on that, along with the regular stuff, all of that, after this. It's the first time I felt like we didn't need to enumerate what the regular stuff was. I have faith in our listeners. But if you are new, yeah. It's Dodgers Rewind, questions from Greg. Those will be at the end. But let's talk about news. Let's talk about what's going on. Today, the Dodgers finished their sweep of Arizona with an afternoon game, and there was an afternoon game yesterday, so I almost said the doubleheader was today, because that's how kind of lost in time I am.
Yeah, they played a 1 p.m. start today, on Wednesday, and that was the second earliest start of the series, because they had a 12 and a 7 game on
Tuesday. Did you go to all these games?
No, okay. I didn't. I got a little sidetracked with work. And it would have been an exceedingly well. It would have been impossible to go to early for me on Tuesday, so I just stayed home for the whole thing.
Sure,
but yeah, it was. It's a lot. That's a lot. A lot of baseball.
So, there are two series against Pittsburgh, against Pennsylvania, the state of Pennsylvania.
That's right.
I was thinking how much I was dreading doing this podcast, because it's never fun to do, especially after a short, like say a week, one bad week. If it's becomes the storyline of a month or a season, then it's worth talking about. But when you have that small sample size, you don't want to read too much into anything, but you also kind of need to talk about it. So I wasn't looking forward to that. And then now granted against Arizona, but hey, Arizona looked good against them in their previous series at Chase Field. Just looked like the, especially on offense, the team we all kind of thought they would look like.
Right. Yeah, that was the thing too, like with Arizona, since they beat the Dodgers 2 out of 3 earlier in the year, and then they played like really well after that, and like their pitching has been great, and then the Dodgers just like absolutely hammered their pitching. So it's like, it's kind of weird. But like, so on the doubleheader thing, yeah, I guess I knew that, you know, because the Dodgers never have rainouts, like I knew doubleheaders were rare. I didn't realize just how rare they've been at Dodger Stadium. Like they hadn't played a doubleheader at home since 1999. And like this one's technically considered a scheduled doubleheader as opposed to like a rainout makeup, because they, you know, it was done like over a month in advance or whatever because of the lockout. But they hadn't even done a scheduled doubleheader since the Pope visited in 1987. So, like that. But even after that, the Dodgers had this uncommon. In April of '88, they had 3 games in a row at home rained out against the Padres, and then they like made those up later in the year with doubleheaders. 2 of them in July, 1 I think in September, and then they had the Rodney King. Verdict in 92 in the LA riots, so they had 4 games postponed, and they ended up playing 4 doubleheaders in a 6-day span in July. Ew. 1 against the Phillies, 3 straight against the Expos. Just a brutal, like 10 games in 6 days. I can't even imagine. Like, I mean, it's different then because, you know, they didn't use 7 pitchers a game back then. Like, so it was like, you didn't always run out of pitchers after like any sign of adversity. So that wasn't, but it was just like very, it was a very weird, weird thing. And then after that, it was just that 99 doubleheader against the Rockies. And then the last rainout at Dodger Stadium was in 2000 against the Astros, but that they made up that game, like on an off day later in the season. So like, they didn't even have a doubleheader then. So it's just, what a weird, you know, take for granted, because like doubleheaders happen all over the place because weather happens places. It just never does in LA. So it was just, it's just weird. It was weird to do. And they're going to have another one in September. So should be interesting.
So let's break down the games. We had some debuts. We had some, not just some, a lot of roster ups and downs and changes kind of throughout the week. I was busy for about a 36-hour period and seemed to, I did see that Ching Green had joined the Dodgers before he got DFA'd, but just barely. That yeah, wouldn't so, have been great if I had taken like a 3-day break from TV and media and then come back and said, you know, seeing Ching Green DFA'd. Wait, what? was on the team?
Because there was a thing where you, yeah, so this all happened since we recorded last. So
yeah.
Shane Green was both added to the team, got a win, and then was DFA'd in between records. So like, but like you texted me on Sunday because I think I tweeted about Shane Green getting a win.
Yeah.
And because you were, I think you were confused just because my tweet was the thing you saw that was like Shane Green.
Yeah. But he's still in baseball. He's still on the Dodgers. He's in the, he got called up.
Yeah. Eagle River. So like, yeah, it was just weird. But then, so there was all the roster turnover. Like, as we, remember last week, we recorded in the morning, like right before getaway day in Pittsburgh, when Ryan Pepiot made his debut, and like, oh man, the changeup was like working early, and then he's like, oh, and then he started walking guys, and then he started walking some more guys, and then he was done after three innings because he walked five guys, although he did not allow a run, and then they ended up losing that game later. And, you know, so that was like a one-day thing, got optioned the next day, but you knew because of the doubleheader, he'd be back for the doubleheader, which he was. Michael Grove came up on Sunday, and that was a weird thing because they also have Andre Jackson in AAA. Mitch White was on the COVID IL and not fully, like, starter stretched out and wasn't activated by Sunday. So, like, anyway, so... that was one thing, but so it could have been Andre Jackson or Michael Grove. Michael Grove was in Double A, Andre Jackson Triple A. Andre Jackson's been going through something, like, because like his last, he has like, I think it's 19 walks and 10 strikeouts this season and a 9 ERA. His last three starts have been absolutely terrible. I think he retired like one of 8 batters the other day in a start. So like something's going on there, but he did not get the call. Michael Grove did for his debut Sunday. But the reason he was called up was because Clayton Kershaw went on the injured list again. So this time, everyone, of course, had to look up what an SI joint was. It's, you know, sort of connects the hip to the lower back. So he's had back stuff before. I know it's sort of varied.
That's a technical term, by the way. Back stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Back stuff. Yeah. You know, they all... You never, no matter what the injury is, like, as soon as it happens, everyone's like, well, we're hopeful it's, you know, it's a short-term thing or whatever. That's, like, literally every single time. Like, someone, like, you know, gets cut in half. He's watching a magician show. They're like, we're hoping, you know, they're going to be okay pretty soon. So he was supposed to, Kershaw was supposed to throw a bullpen today on Wednesday. Still having pain in that lower back hip area, so that was scrapped. He's still playing catch, so he's not, like, completely sidelined, but it's going to be a little bit, so probably a few weeks at least. Then you have Andrew Heaney, who's been out since early April. He had the left shoulder thing going on. He threw a bullpen session on Tuesday, but he said today, I think, that he's like a few weeks before he's back. He still needs at least like 2 rehab starts, maybe 3. So it's going to be a little bit for him. So they're in a bit of a scramble still. They're like one starter short. And, you know, that sort of roster turn we talked about, like, the other thing now is it's sort of hard getting used to this because we weren't used to it for a couple of years. But, pitchers getting sent down or on the IL are 15 days now instead of 10. So, like, they option Grove and Pepiot both after their starts. Pepiot's return for the doubleheader doesn't count against that. So it's just, It's as if he never came up, even though he did for a day. But Pepiot can't return until May 27th. Grove can't return until May 31st. So they're already doing a bullpen game Saturday in Philadelphia. They're going to probably need another one in between when they can call someone up. So, or I guess, yeah, it's just going to be interesting to see how they sort of maneuver this. But it's going to be Scramble City for a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. It's been a lot. But yeah, through all that, they've still, overall, played pretty well. I know it could have been a lot worse. Like you were talking about, they have won their last five, but they lost four in a row before that, and they were very close to losing on Sunday. They were one out away.
The Phillies series was so weird because the Pirates series, there was weird travel stuff. They just kind of looked in a funk. The Phillies series, they just got beat.
Yeah,
Bryce Harper became Barry Bonds in a real quick hurry. You need to do is not have a working UCL and you become Superman.
It was the weird week that the pitching finally imploded a little bit.
Yeah,
Tyler Anderson was very bad. Julio Urias had his worst start ever. Bueller gave up five runs. The bullpen was giving up runs, and I think it was something in their first. What was it, 26 games? I think they gave up 15 home runs. And then last week in seven games, they gave up 13 home runs. So it was
all of that, in two of the losses against Philadelphia,
were coming back. Yeah. Right. They've been erasing deficits for a week and a half now. They won their last five. All five of those technically count as a comeback win. Today was the first time they scored first in nine games. they in the previous eight, they fell behind at least 2-0 in every single game. And then, the ones they won, but in two of the last two losses against the Phillies. No, it was it the last two. No, the first two losses against the Phillies, they erased big deficits, but then ultimately lost. But it's just been this very weird, back and forth. But the offense is not that, Mookie that offense Betts. Is sort of,
the player we all know. Cause we've talked about it before. Last year, kind of a down year, still really good. But this is the not just really good, really outstandingly, exceptionally good over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Real sort of carrying them, scoring a lot at the top. Justin Turner getting his power back, hitting a lot of doubles last week, hitting a lot of home runs recently. He's homered the last two games, looking really well. Just overall, for the most part, everyone's doing well. Edwin Rios, making the most of his occasional playing time. He's hit a bunch of home runs recently. Max Muncy, I know his average is still super low. But he's second in the major leagues in walks right now. But so as of right now, Muncy has 19 hits on the season and 29 walks. Only Juan Soto has more. But even with all that, he's hitting, I forgot exactly what his average is. I think it's 160 something. But he has a 97 WRC plus right now because it's just a weird year. Although I will say that's another thing that's made, the baseball season is weird. You can't really trust Major League Baseball in terms of the consistency of the baseball, and the balls have been flying more this last week, and they've obviously hit more home runs, but it goes both ways. It's like they were, giving up more, perhaps than you would think given the ball, but they're not totally a function of how the ball's doing, how their offense is doing. They've been, even when they're down, they're still leading. They've been leading the majors in runs all year. So it hasn't been super bad or good one way or the other. They've been pretty consistent in that regard, but it's just been a very weird year. But back to Muncy for a second. Only four times has a Dodger with at least 300 plate appearances finished a season with more walks than hits. How many of them can you name?
I am going to butcher this question right after this break. How many players, or I guess seasons, can I name where a Dodger with at least 300 plate appearances had more walks than hits in a season?
My first hint to you is it's only three players.
Okay.
One of them did it twice.
Okay. So I'm going to throw out a couple of names, and then I'll ask for a hint,
yeah,
and then I'm going to give up. How about that?
Yep.
Jim Gilliam.
No.
Max Muncy.
No.
Okay. Then I need a hint here, friend. And if okay, it's a bad hint, I'm just quitting. Not the question. I'll show. First, let you do it.
First hint is only one of them played for Los Angeles Dodgers.
Thanks,
and pal. And that player was a starter on a World Series team for them.
Okay. I'm not sure that's going to help me much. I'll throw out, so I have two strikes. I'll throw out one more name and then I'm packing it in. Yeah. Name randomly. I can't guess old friend Zach Wheat because he got a lot of hits. Nope. Babe Herman.
No, I don't have numbers in front of me. I will say, so Max Muncy, I guess he didn't, 2020 was a weird year and I did search equal to or more, but he only had 248 plate appearances in 2020, but he did have 39 hits and 39 walks that year. But in his other years with the Dodgers, the gap between hits and walks, the smallest gap was 27. Nope, I'm reading that wrong. 25.
Okay.
He had, but he's always had more hits, at least 25 more hits than walks in other years. So it's very weird this year. The player who did it twice was Eddie Stanky in 1945 and 46. And he was like a ridiculous extreme type player. He walked 148 times and 137 times in those years. So like, and he had 143 and 132 hits. So he like leading the majors in walks and all that kind of stuff, and led in on base percentage one of those years. He led in runs scored one of those years. The other person I had never heard of, the earliest one was Tony Smith in 1910. Possible future Dodgers rewind because of that. No, not this week. Spoiler alert. No. But then Jim Wynn is the LA Dodger. But he did it in 1975. He made the World Series in 74 with the Dodgers.
How many names do you think I needed to go through before I guessed Jim Wynn?
I was trying to think of like the hints. It would have...
No,
I think...
Like
it would have gotten to the point where I would have had to literally say the toy cannon.
Yeah.
And even then it would have been... It was like a 50-50 shot at that point. And
at that point, I'm so demoralized. I just guessed Zach Wheat anyways. Babe Herman was a bad guess. He way more hits than walks. Gilliam was a decent guess. Led the league in walks.
I guess I should have recognized how hard this question was. And when you said Jim Gilliam, I should have said you're half right, because that would have been the best hit.
Did lead the league in walks with 96 walks in 1959, but still had 156 hits. So,
yeah.
That was the only straw I had to go on. So. You have a Dodgers rewind. I'm excited to hear it.
Yeah, so we talked about the 92 doubleheaders where they had four doubleheaders in 6 days. Like, I vaguely remember. You got to remember, like, this is the era of not every game was on TV. I was looking back because I was going to write about this, but it was just too much in the weeds on some of the stuff. But essentially, around this time, the Dodgers had about 50 games on TV during the year. That's like in 90 to 94-ish era. And then they started getting a little bit more after that. But because it was still very much the, we need to sell tickets. So road games get televised. But if we televise home games, it's going to be... it's going to hurt our ticket sales too much. So, like, they did have, Z Channel and Select TV, I think, which also had, like, Lakers stuff that did home games, but that was a paid subscription thing, which growing up I never had. So, like, that was something that was one of those, like, a luxury. Like, I mean, we never had HBO, or anything like that. And this was, like, considered, like, a higher premium than that. So, like, there was no chance I was ever going to get that channel. But anyway, one of the players on that 92 team, I was sort of looking in that little 6-day span to see who played a bunch. there wasn't really that many like memorable like games or performances, but one of the guys who played quite a bit was Mitch Webster. And I know like he has a pretty unique story, so I wanted to do him anyway. I was actually a little surprised we hadn't done him on a Dodgers Rewind before, so this is good. He played in those four doubleheaders. He played in seven of the eight games. He only started three of them, but that kind of defined what his role was in his time with the Dodgers. He hit a pinch single for Oral Hershiser in the seventh inning of the second game on July 6th. That was the start of a four-run rally against the Expos that won the game. Mitch Webster, he was born at... I think I've heard this city pronounced Learned, Kansas, but it's L-A-R-N-E-D. Is it Larned?
I don't know. It's you don't fairly know. Far southwest, so I'm actually looking up now. There's Edward Street Brew and Bites.
So, wait, are there any Z's in that name?
No.
Okay. So we can only hope my family, I've never been back to Kansas, and I know this is... Yet. Travesty, because you live there in Kansas, and like I need to visit anyway at some point. So,
you know they do come they do play the Royals this year.
Ooh, in a minute. But my my family was in Salina, and I was looking up, and it's about 100 miles. That's Learned is about 100 miles east or no west, excuse me, of Salina, and that's already far west from you. So like.
Yeah, but the Koozie Inn is in Salina, the best slider in America. So,
and
still worth going
to. I have had, and I think we've talked about this before, but I had it, a day later during a family reunion in Colorado, where one of my uncles drove to Kansas for something and then drove back to Colorado for the reunion, and with like a cooler full of Cozy Burgers that we froze and then reheated the next day, and they were still great. Like that's the sign of a great burger when you go through that process and it's still excellent. So I knew they were very good. And plus, for years, my mom had it was probably something where she went back to Kansas. I think one of the years, I don't know if I was in college or no, I think I might've been in high school, but I just didn't, I don't remember if I was working or I didn't feel like why would I go. I should have went back at some point because I think there was something in Kansas and I wanted to go back and see it, and I could have gone to Cozy and all this, but we had a cup like I would use all the time for like a Cozy Inn cup. So
do you think
that was cool.
Mitch Webster used a Cozy Inn cup?
I would hope so.
Yeah, made the trip, came back.
I looked up his 92 Topps baseball card was one I have. I think there's a few more. This is one I have. I don't know if you can see it. But on the back here in the, so I guess end of 91, it lists his home as Great Bend, Kansas. So he seems like a Kansas guy, through and through from what I found. The Dodgers actually originally drafted him back in 1977. Same year that he was in the 23rd round, and then same year in the 35th round, they drafted John Shoemaker, who was a minor leaguer for them for a few years, but then quickly got into coaching, and he's still coaching because he's their captain of player development. He's been there forever. Just one of the pretty unique sort of stories. Like he's the definition of a lifer, and Webster was almost that as well. I couldn't find exactly what this was. I don't think it was the Rule 5 draft. It unless it was the minor league portion of the Rule 5 draft. But anyway, in December of 1979, the Blue Jays drafted away Mitch Webster from the Dodgers. I think that's what it was, the minor league portion of the Rule 5, because he didn't have to like stay in the majors or anything. He ended up debuting like 4 years later in 1983 with Toronto. He played for the Blue Jays, the Expos, the Cubs, Cleveland, and then the Pirates. He was a regular for a good portion of that, especially with the Expos. But then like towards the end, like he was struggling in 1991, with Pittsburgh. And then, so he was traded to the Dodgers, but the guy he was traded for was struggling a lot worse. Jose Gonzalez, who was sort of always hyped as a prospect for like the last 5 or 6 years. July 3rd, 1991, Dodgers sent him to Pittsburgh for Mitch Webster. Gonzalez was 0 for 28 on the season at that point. I didn't remember that he was 0 for 28, because I was trying to look up to see what they said in the paper around the trade. And they were just like, I think one of the headlines was like, Dodgers finally get rid of hitless Gonzalez. It's like, good Lord. But that's the that's the second most at bats in a Dodgers season with no hits. Eugenio Velez famously had 0-for-37, which was the worst. And he's even, Gonzalez was even ahead of like the rest of the list. Like, I think the next 10, I think all of them but one are pitchers. And Sandy Koufax was third with 26 at bats. Max Scherzer last year, 24 all with the Dodgers. And he was something like 0-for-60 or something on the season, counting the Nationals. Brett Tomko was 0-for-24 one year with the Dodgers. Webster sort of knew his role right away. The 25th man, that's what I am here, he told Steve Dilbeck of the San Bernardino Sun right after the trade. I'm a reserve outfielder. I'm a role player on this team. I accept that. I try to be the best role player I can be. So 91, this was when Daryl Strawberry was still like productive. He had a good year that year, actually. And the Dodgers were actually a really good team that year. They just narrowly missed out on the winning the division. But they had Brett Butler and Daryl Strawberry in the outfield. And then it was kind of a grab bag after that. So, you know, then they would end up, though Cal Daniels was the other one. So, like, it really was like a reserve outfielder role. They ended up getting Eric Davis the next year. So, same thing. Like, he was basically like a reserve, and he was sort of geared for that. And he just sort of stuck around for the next 5 years. He actually led the Dodgers in pinch hit plate appearances in 1992. His 17 hits, pinch hits that year, were a club record. Although Dave Hansen beat it the next year. Webster was like near the top of most often used pinch hitter the next few years with the Dodgers, you know, top three or four on the team. His 43 pinch hits with the Dodgers are tied for fifth most in franchise history, tied with Duke Snider, who, that's a lot of pinch hits for someone, although I'm sure a lot of those probably came later in his career because he started so often, obviously. As a pinch hitter, Webster hit 251, 318, 366. Overall, he hit 256, 320, 392. That is a 99 WRC plus with the Dodgers. Over his career, he had a 102 WRC plus. So right around a league average offensive guy for like 13 years. And he had speed. He led the league in triples one year. He hit 13 with the Expos in 86. He tied for the Dodgers lead with 5 sacrifice flies in 1992. I'm sure that will come up in a few minutes. after his playing career, though, he did. This was obviously later than Shoemaker, who didn't make the majors. But right away, he was like already like going to be a coach in the Dodgers minors. Like right after he started playing, so his last playing year was 95. His first coaching year was 96. He was a coach in the Dodgers minors for 4 years. Then he switched to being an amateur scout from 2000 to 2007. Among the players his area that he signed or drafted and signed were Scott Van Slyke, Scott Elbert, Blake DeWitt, Joel Hanrahan. Both Elbert and DeWitt were in the same first round in 2004. I was reading something about this. I don't remember if the Dodgers had like the same scout do like two first round picks like that. Marty Lamb had a few prolific drafts. I think he had the top, it was either 3 out of the first 5 or possibly the top 3 or something draft picks one year, but it wasn't both in the first round. But I think when Ken Gernick wrote about it back then, he like sort of mentioned most prolific since, Mitch Webster signed, you know, the 2 first rounders back in 04. So he had a pretty notable career doing like scouting. He switched to being a pro scout in 08 and 09, which is instead of going out and, you know, high school and college people, you're going to pro games and major league games and getting ahead, trying to do advanced scouting, that kind of stuff. He in another Ken Gernick sort of mailbag column, he noted that Webster was one of the scouts responsible for scouting the Cardinals ahead of the NLDS in 2009. And they won that. And then he left to join the Royals. Again, I think just probably wanting to go back to Kansas at that point, or near Kansas. And as one of their scouting directors in 2009. So I mentioned 1992, Mitch Webster, 5 sacrifice flies. That tied for the Dodgers team lead. He tied 2 other players. Can you name them?
Probably not. Just a little side note while I stall. While you were going over that, I was editing the Kansas Sports Hall of Fame Wikipedia page, which listed Mitch Webster. At least it was linked to on Mitch Webster's. Oh, he's not linked on the page itself. I'm going to have to do another edit. But they had other baseball Kansan and Bill Russell linked to basketball Bill Russell. So fixed that error.
Bill Russell, disambiguation.
I have to guess good a player stall. Who played in 1992. Yeah. You know,
you have to guess two, actually.
Oh, good. I was six when this happened. I had lived in LA for 2 years. I had played T-ball at this point, so I basically should have been an expert.
Right.
I don't know. Mike Piazza.
Oh, you played T-ball? Name five teams. Piazza did play in 1992, but he had zero sacrifice flies. I think his major league debut was September that year.
Hack. Eric Karros,
rookie of the year, 1992. Yeah. He had five sacrifice flies. He was one of the people who tied. Team lead. RBI man.
Dave Hansen.
Dave Hansen, aforementioned pinch hitter. He was only 23 that year, but he did have two sacrifice flies. But there were quite a few with more than him.
All right, that's all I got.
Todd Benzinger was the other one.
All right. You know, I could have if this had been later in the 90s, I would have started naming Todds, but not in 92. Right. Not with that Todd.
The people with more than two, there were two others, both Mikes, Mike Socia, Mike Sharperson, each had three. So
there you go.
Yep. Yeah. Fun times.
Well, I get to table the turns because it's time for
with Dean and Craig. We love them.
Eric loves it.
Oh, I was late again on this one.
Well, this week has gotten better off than all of last week until Bellinger's triple in the ninth of the Sunday. With that, here are this week's questions. The Dodgers travel to Philadelphia this weekend, so I thought we'd talk about Dodger leaders in the city of brotherly love at Citizens Bank Ballpark. So, therefore, it's all me. I should know these answers. I won't, and I don't have to answer because I have the answers in front of me. I mean, I guess I could answer and look really smart.
Yep.
Can Eric named the five Dodgers who have hit four or more home runs at Citizens Bank Ballpark. Four are still active and three are still Dodgers. And I am going to assume this is as a Dodger.
Okay, yeah. So I think...
Otherwise, Jason Wirth hanging out.
It's like Jimmy Rollins, Chase Utley, like we're just going through. I don't remember the exact year it opened. I want to say it was like roughly like 2005-ish. That's sort of where my head is. It might be a little later than that, but
I'll look that up.
I'm going to start with Matt Kemp.
No.
How about Matt Kemp? No. Wow. That's surprising. Okay. Citizens Bank Park. See, that like already,
by the way.
Okay. So that throws me into a tizzy here because and I'm okay. Another thing, I'm assuming this is regular season only, not that there were like not that the Dodgers were bombing home runs in the back-to-back NLCS losses, but wow, this is I'm mad a little bit this now. So okay, let's just go with the longevity a little bit, I guess. Justin Turner
had 13 games, he had five. He's one of the four.
Okay. Andre Ethier?
Only four home runs in 33 games.
Adrian Gonzalez?
Three in 13 games.
I'm doing well on the three guys. What about... I'm trying to think of like someone who may have had like a big game there that I'm just forgetting. But let's just say Jock Peterson.
Nope.
Like I'm grasping at straws right now.
I'll give you one more guess. Ron guess and you're done.
Yeah. So let's just logically think about this. Yasiel Puig. I don't know.
Leading with six, Yasmani Grandal.
Okay.
And then two tied with Justin Turner with five, with Cody Bellinger and Max Muncy.
Wow. All right. Who's the other?
That's it, right? They're sorry. Okay. He was asking for four more. I thought he was only. I got my four and five mixed up. So under ETH your accounts, you get credit for that. I apologize.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Cool. Several Dodgers have hit well at Citizens Bank Ballpark. Can Eric name the seven Dodgers who have a 946?
Come on. The classic
946. Man. Now I will let you know, these are also everyone that has a 900 or above. There's 946 is the lowest in that category. with a minimum of 40 plate appearances.
Okay.
Four are still active, two are still on the Dodgers.
Okay, so going back to the well again here, let's just go like Justin Turner and Yasmani Grandal, since those were the big homer guys.
Yasmani Grandal leaves with a 1.246 and Justin Turner with a 1.074.
And then because it is, well, and then I'll go back. Wait, you said only two of them are active
on the Dodgers? Four are active, two are on the Dodgers.
Max Muncy?
Has the 946.
That's exactly what I was thinking. And then, so, seven Dodgers. Good Lord. So, there's no other active Dodgers?
Correct. You got Justin Turner and Max Muncy.
Okay. So, let's go to Andre Ethier?
No, only an 849.
What a slacker. What about...
Strike one, by the way.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Matt Kemp?
Third with a 1.016.
All right. I'm going to go back to Adrian Gonzalez, even though I'm not that enthused about it.
Just missed the 900 mark with an 897. Strike two.
What about Yasiel Puig?
821. Three you missed were Jock Peterson with a 983, Russell Martin with a 954, and James Loney with a 988.
Wow. All right.
Going to the pitchers. Well, number one might be obvious. Can Eric name the five Dodgers that have a total of 16 or more strikeouts in their games at Citizens Bank Ballpark? Hint, four are on the 2022 team roster.
All right.
Though none of them are going to be pitching for the Dodgers this weekend in Philadelphia.
Right.
There's your hint.
So obviously Kershaw.
Yeah, number one with 49.
Kenley.
With 19. A 2022 roster, by the way, not on the Dodgers.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, so
I will also say what I was thinking at first was Chad Billingsley.
With 25 strikeouts.
Okay. And then Walker Buehler.
Walker Buehler only has 14.
Let's see. He's also not pitching this weekend. Okay.
So you're missing two names.
Oh, okay. And you said...
Both are still in baseball.
Yeah, I got... Major League Baseball. Again, I did the... A 2022 roster instead of Dodgers. So my head was in a weird spot there.
Yep.
So again, only 3 years, but he probably pitched there three times, or maybe did, or he might have only done it twice. But Zach Greinke?
No, only 11.
Okay.
In two games.
Hyunjin Ryu?
No.
Kenta Maeda.
Kenta Maeda with 22 strikeouts in four games.
So am I missing one?
You are missing one who had four games from 2016 to 2019.
Ross Stripling?
There you go. Well done. All right, last question, and you don't have to name a gazillion players. This is a good one. Only two Dodger pitchers have executed a successful pickoff at Citizens Bank Ballpark. One of them should be obvious.
Kershaw.
One of them should be the first guess, but I'll give Eric five more guesses to name the other pitcher. All right, I like this.
Okay.
So you get Kershaw. You get five guesses to name the other one.
Okay, let's go Ryu.
Nope.
Urias.
Nope.
Chris Capuano.
No.
Randy Wolf.
Nope. For your last guess, I'm going to give you the year 2008.
2008. Derek Lowe.
Noted bobblehead robe wearer Joe Bible.
Ah. See, my strategy was all lefties and then I strayed at the end. Damn it.
Good job, though. You did good. Looking at Julio Urias' early rate stats, you can see the higher opponent's batting average and slugging to go along with higher home run percentage and drop in strikeout percentage. This also corresponds with what he has looked like in his early starts. Do you think it is too early to be concerned?
I was probably more concerned early, like when his fastball was down. But I think the problem the last couple times were like his command's just been terrible, like a little bit. So I don't know. Like, I'm not. He gave up like 11 hits to the Pirates, you know. But he still kind of sort of pitched his way through that game a little bit. It wasn't terrible, but then the start against the Phillies was bad. Like, he was really bad. But yeah, I don't know if that was like he's done bad or. You know, we'll see. But like, I guess his velocity not had it like completely cratered, I would be more worried. But like, he's still got a little bit more rope, I think, until it's like completely time to worry, in my opinion. But I don't know. Who knows?
All right. For the contest, one of you can have Freddie Freeman hitting 44 or more doubles this season, and the other of you can have Mookie Betts scoring 116 or more runs this season. Both of these accomplishments would put them among the best five LA Dodgers season totals since 1958. If you don't think either of them will reach those numbers, then you can that can be your choice, and then your podcast colleague will get both Betts and Freeman trying to accomplish those numbers. Jacob can pick first. Oh, thanks, Greg. Thinking, you know, mm-hmm. I think this mental breakthrough is real. I'm going with Mookie Betts.
Okay, so you say he's going to score at least 116 runs.
Yes,
I agree with you. In fact, I think he's going to score at least 120. But I will, just to give some context here. I want to make sure it's still through right now. But okay, so Mookie Betts, 36 runs scored, leads the majors by 4 over Mike Trout at the moment through 37 team games. Freddie Freeman has 14 doubles. That's tied for 3rd in the majors. Rafael Devers and his replacement, Matt Olson in Atlanta, have 15. So both are on paces to do well over the numbers here, but I will gladly take Freeman getting to 44 doubles. So yeah, I like it. I'm mad I didn't get both, actually. what would you have chosen though? Like, so huh? You would have been like off the board, like
what? I could either have picked neither or one of them. I couldn't have picked both. I would, you know, ooh, that would have been fun. I could have done that. All right. As of Wednesday morning, there are 6 teams over 500 in both the AL and NL. How many of those teams will be in the playoff position on July 1st? It's confusing. Oh, 6 okay, so each. Got it. Sorry. I was like, what? There's more than that.
He said over 500, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because I think... Oh, no, the White Sox lost. Okay. So, yeah. So, it's Yankees. And that's Yankees
as of before today's games. So.
Right. So, it didn't change much because there were only like, no one's really like right on the margin there.
The White Sox and Guardians are the White Sox are 500 on the dot right now, but
right. But they're out, right? Like, but yeah, so Yankees, Astros, Angels, Rays, Twins, Blue Jays. So you have three, like, I guess. All 6 of those actually can make it because 2 wild cards from the East, 1 from the West. But I was like, wait a minute, is this going to be a thing where one of them gets screwed? But no. I actually do think all six of those teams will make
it. Wow.
So,
I can't. We did this preseason. I can't even remember
exactly
what I picked.
Yeah, right.
I probably was higher on the White Sox, like most of baseball. Looking at the list of teams outside right now. Again, maybe you think the White Sox will turn around, but it's been looking kind of rough out there. Maybe you could, like Jeff Passan, buy into the Mariners kind of getting things situated. But other than that, that looks like a pretty solid six.
You could almost argue that the National League is even more top heavy. You mentioned maybe the Phillies like figure something out. they don't play the Dodgers again after this weekend, so they don't get their offense back on track.
Well, only thing, if you look at the National League right now, that is puzzling is the Braves.
Yeah, that's true.
Who are they're probably gonna four games below 500 right now, 17
and getting 21. Outscored. Yeah. I guess the one saving grace, so like the Blue Jays, right? They're the worst over 500 team right now, and they're getting outscored on the season. But I think they're to a point where they have like a really good starting staff, but also their offense should be good enough to like overcome a lot, and maybe they just haven't yet.
Mm-hmm.
So like I'm still confident that they could play better, but in the National League, like that's a good point about the Braves. But so it's the three teams from the NL West, and then the Mets in the East, and then it's Brewers Cardinals in the Central. Those are the the only 500 teams. And then so it's a matter of do like the Braves catch one of the Cardinals or let's say the Giants or you know whichever or the Giants and Padres
maybe you argue right Brewers Padres Giants. Certainly not the Dodgers, although if you recall from my preseason prediction, I still believe in the Mets curse. Just you wait. They're looking really, really, really good right now, and that's without Jacob DeGrom. But just you wait.
Until July or something. I think, in fact, I didn't see... I think Max Scherzer like came out of the game tonight at some point. I don't know exactly why. But I think he like motioned to the dugout or something. So maybe you're onto something here with this curse. But yeah, who knows. But I'm just going to say... Wait, so I guess... This isn't for the content. We're just talking about it. Is this for the contest? I guess everything's for the contest. The quote-unquote contest that doesn't exist.
Craig didn't specify, but I'll leave that up to you.
Oh, this is in a playoff position on July 1st. Okay. You know what? I'm just going to go... Yeah, all 12 of them will still be in playoff position by July 1st. Why not?
Yeah, sure. That works.
Yeah.
All right. Final question. I have not ordered a shake at an ice cream store or fast food in some time, but I saw a ranking that gave In-N-Out shakes a high rating. Eric, did you ever work the shake machine when you worked there, and did that experience ruin shakes forever for you? And for both of you, did you ever register for a free Baskin-Robbins ice cream cone on your birthday since we both grew up in Southern California?
Probably... Although I can't specifically remember if I did that. I might have done that as an adult, actually, to get something free. Or maybe that was just their app. But I will say this. I worked both at McDonald's and In-N-Out in high school and a little bit into college for In-N-Out. But my only, ruin forever, and forever's in quotes here, was when I was at McDonald's working, just the back, like the lard and the everything just seemed really gross, you know? And then I was like, well, I'm never eating this food again. And then I think like within a week I was like, well, no, it's probably still fine. Like, you know, that kind of a thing. But no, the shakes were like pretty normal. Both places that I recall, I think In-N-Out, it was a very easy process. It wasn't like hands spun. I don't know if Carl's does that or like the machine's a little more involved. It's literally just like carton of like, you know, already like processed stuff that you're pouring into a machine, and then you just like basically hit the button to have it come out. Like that's kind of it. So there's not a lot of work going on, so it's not really a thing, and you're basically, it's not like it was never busy to the point where one person one person's role was the shake machine. It was more if you're on drive through, or if you're taking orders, or there, when I worked there, there wasn't self-serve drinks. So there was, and during busy times, one person would be responsible for like getting drinks together for all the orders, and that included shakes. But if you're in the drive-thru, you like had to sort of handle that too. But to me, In-N-Out shakes are very bad. Like, not very bad, just like ordinary and blah. Mm-hmm. McDonald's kind of the same way. To me, like, maybe growing up they tasted better, but like there's nothing much there. I have never been much of a chocolate shake person generally. I usually go for the strawberry, but like it's all just kind of gross. Not gross, it's just not very good. Like, for me, like Carl's Jr., Del Taco, like, they have much better like strawberry shakes, much better just general shakes than those places now. So I don't know. Like, yeah, it's just, it's not that it was ruined for me. I just don't think the taste is like that good. Like, just generally.
I like In-N-Out shake, but it's definitely a different breed. And yeah, it's inferior, a different texture than like a real actual made right. milkshake. Yeah, they're fine. And I was not signed up for the birthday Baskin Robbins, as far as I remember. If Carvel had something like that, I was, because we went all the time. But I actually don't think they had that either. So,
I'm trying to think. I think the last few times I've gone to Baskin Robbins to actually buy a shake, I did get mint chip shake. If you're gonna like go out of your way to go to an ice cream shop to get a shake, like. Well, my two favorite flavors are mint chip and strawberry. So, like, you know, you're not going to get, like, I guess it, Jack in the Box, I think, sometimes has a mint chip shake. But, like, that's hard to find places. So, you know, you can get strawberry just about anywhere, fast food-wise. But, like, if you're going to go out of your way to go to Baskin Robbins, that's when I get the mint chip shake, if I'm getting it. But, yeah, I don't know. But, yeah, In-N-Out just seemed pretty plain to me. And, like, McDonald's was probably maybe even a little more runny. I don't know if that's the right word. But same texture-wise, like, just kind of, like, ordinary. Nothing special.
Well, I'm upset with this question because normally I get to go, like, claim whatever it is Craig's talking about. But I believe every place in Lawrence, we're recording this fairly late at night for me, is closed. And I can't get a shake. And could go to the grocery store and get ingredient, but no, I'm too lazy for that. So I'm upset. This is Craig's fault.
Ugh. That's what we get for shaking up our recording schedule this week.
Very well done.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. A little bit of a teaser. In probably a couple weeks, we're going to start having a little more, some more quick hitter podcasts.
What?
You'll see some different stuff. We'll talk about that later.
But you didn't tell me.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you then.